The state of South Dakota ratified the 19th Amendment on December 4th, 1919. But the debate over women's voting rights had already been rippling and raging across the prairie for decades. The conversation was influenced by climate, geography, immigration, and the forced removal of indigenous people. To help celebrate the 100th anniversary, we welcomed Molly Rosen to In the Moment. She's an associate professor of history at the University of South Dakota and the Ronald R. Nelson Chair of Great Plains in South Dakota History. She's also co-editor of the book Equality at the Ballot Box, Votes for Women on the Northern Great Plains. She and In the Moment host Lori Walsh had this conversation.
Dr. Rosen, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
This is such a fascinating conversation that, of course, we will be having all throughout 2020. But let's start with this idea that it's been 100 years this week since South Dakota ratified the 19th Amendment, but that conversation has started really decades earlier.
Sure. Well, and I'd just like to say that last night in the Capitol and Pier, about 7 p.m., in front of a suffrage-themed Christmas tree, Governor Noem signed an official proclamation commemorating the 100th anniversary of South Dakota's ratification of the 19th Amendment. So that is one way we're sort of honoring the 100th anniversary and our participation in it.
And not insignificant that that is South Dakota's first female governor making that proclamation. That had to be a special moment, whatever your politics are.
Exactly. And she, in her inaugural speech, she actually, referenced woman suffrage and understood that, this was a historic moment. I am proud of how far we have come, she said.
And now you have to tell me what a suffrage-themed Christmas tree is.
Oh, well, at the Capitol, to celebrate the Christmas season, they have various trees decorated in all sorts of themes. And one of the themes this year was a suffrage one, a woman suffrage one, where they to communicate the values of the suffragists.
Right. I'm just curious what the ornaments were. I want to get close up and see what's on that tree. But I guess we'll have to take a trip to Pier to do that.
And there are a number of, I know friends have given me, there are a number of ornaments actually, in the shape of suffrage women. And, there's quite a bit of commercial stuff out there. So, and I imagine there's a good number of patriotic kind of flags and things.
There's going to be more, I think, as we look at the 100th anniversary. Let's talk about some of those women and who are some of the women who made a difference in women's suffrage here in the Great Plains?
Of course, there are very many of them. One of the important ones for this last moment of ratification of the 19th Amendment was Mary Mamie Shields Pyle. She was then president of League of Women Voters because South Dakota, of course, had passed women's suffrage in November 1918, but they were all there to push our governor, who at the time was Peter Norbeck, to go ahead, and they even envisioned being the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment. They weren't quite the first state, but they had to convince him to hold a special session because at the time, of course, South Dakota the legislature only met every other year, and it was the off year. And finally, the state's politicians agreed to pay the expenses themselves to come to the Capitol to have a special session to ratify the 19th Amendment. They were also going to be in town because of a new primary law and to do party business in a convention and elect nominees for the next election. But it was quite something. Once they got there, they wanted to do it in as little time as possible. So they met in a special session on December 3rd, 1919, and they introduced the resolution into both houses. It passed, but they had to wait a day. So then they came back at midnight. It was the midnight session. And shortly after midnight, they ratified it. And then many got on the trains at 2 in the morning to go back to their homes. So it was quite a story. And when the woman suffragists of the time, Mary Pyle being one of the ones to really lead this, told the story. She, you know, they stressed the winter months and people leaving their cattle and one man, you know, rushing home from Minneapolis, telling his wife to send his clothes to appear later, and another one who supposedly had to use three different cars to get there because of the snow. So it was, you know, they were quite pleased with it all.
Yeah. So at that point, they are all in. But yet I want to go back to this idea of it was they're not the first state. There's decades that go by where this conversation is you know,
yes.
There's an opportunity at 1889 at statehood to include this, to include women in the electorate. And that doesn't happen. What's going on there with that conversation so long? Yeah.
Well, and that's part of the significance of why this was so important to be early to ratify is South Dakotans and suffrage advocates, men and women, have been working on this for years. Since 1868-69 territorial session was the first, and then our Constitution of 1889 actually required the state legislature to pass a referendum for the people to vote on in 1890 at our first post-statehood election. South Dakota had actually six campaigns to win woman suffrage. It may have been, I'm not entirely sure on this, but it may have been the most campaigns in any state. So the fact that, you know, it's wonderful on one hand we had so many campaigns, but of course, it suggests it failed many times, but it does mean that South Dakotans were talking about woman suffrage for 50 years. Mm-hmm. It was always a part of our political debate and through the ups and downs of it. And I think that that is why they were so interested in sort of saying, let us be first in ratifying, because now that we won this vote. The other thing was, when woman suffrage was passed in 1918, it was passed as a part of a larger bill that refined voting rights generally, or voting requirements generally in the state. And so suffrage was sort of submerged there in that victory. So,
and for clarity for listeners, when you say 1918, that's when it's in the state, and then 1919 is when we ratify the amendment itself.
Yes.
So people are clear about why we're throwing out those two different years here.
Yes.
What are some of the challenges? Because clearly some of the things we still deal with in South Dakota were challenges back then, such as, the distance and the rural nature of the state and the weather.
Well, yeah. In fact, that 1890 campaign, the state was gripped in drought. You know, people didn't have money to support a campaign, and, you know, riding on wagons and horses, and the letters of the suffragists talk about, you know, and they tried to reach everyone in the community. They went county, their organizations spread across counties and townships, and, you know, they tried to reach everyone, and it was sometimes a struggle to get there, definitely, and then to win the support. Many in the state were, you know, some of the challenges that they felt were there were liquor interests who felt that if women had the power to vote, they would make the state always a prohibition state.
Right.
So that was a challenge.
Tell me in your research, because some of the things as I read through the book Equality at the Ballot Box, I'm just getting mm-hmm. started on it. I'm so excited to keep going and have this, we're going to have so many conversations in 2020.
Yeah, yeah.
Are some of the things that the anti-suffragists are really saying, some of the excuses that now seem humorous, offensive, mm-hmm. and familiar? All at the same time, as you do research and connect with other historians, what are some of the things that you heard people were saying that why we didn't need women in the ballot box?
Well, one of the persistent challenges they had is many said, well, women didn't want it. Mm. Women didn't want the vote. Women didn't want the vote. And in response to that, the suffragists filed massive petitions with all sorts of signatures across the state saying, yes, we want the vote. They didn't want to they thought that this was not a realm for women to participate in. And you have to remember, back then, a lot of, although things were reforming, we didn't have the standard polling places we do now in community centers and armories and thing and whatever is available. You know, a lot of times these elections and balloting were done in bars or places women didn't want to be, and so there was an unsavory aspect to it. And many women were, you know, convinced that they would be better off influencing their husbands and the national scene. Paula Nelson, in the book Equality at the Ballot Box, she has a long article on really considering deeply women's rural women's ideas about womanhood and how, you know, they just clung to some of the traditional roles and felt that that was their place.
Your influence in politics is by conversation with your husband, for example.
Yes. Or your son. You know, the way you raise them, the kind of home atmosphere you give, and, you know, that sort of thing.
I want to talk about what's planned for the centennial celebration in South Dakota, but I also want to touch on this idea that as we celebrate and use that word freely, there's also a reckoning that comes with the women's suffrage movement, forced removal of indigenous people, racism and partnerships with, pro-slavery factions. There's a lot to reckon with as well. What are some of those, as you see it, questions that we need to be asking as we celebrate 100 years about the cost?
Well, the costs are, you know, there was much delay in terms of letting indigenous people vote in the state, you know, not just women, but men too, all indigenous people. I mean, I think it's not until about 1951 that, you know, most of the barriers are taken away, and we still have voting rights challenges. We're still, South Dakota is still considered under the voting rights law of 1964. But my own research deals somewhat with this, and it made settlers or settler society, you know, a little nervous that indigenous men might be voting in 1889. And while our state constitution didn't say anything about how or what the procedure would be for indigenous peoples to vote, all of a sudden, politicians and some businessmen around the state became nervous, and they tried to, in 1890, restrict Native voting. Now, that particular measure lost for many reasons, but there was a law later put in 1903 to restrict voting in the state, and then there were other federal laws that kept Natives from voting, too, so there was a struggle.
So you have this intersection between restrictions on voting and forced citizenship at the same time.
Yes, 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 definitely, definitely. And as far as, you know, my research has revealed so far, we do have one mixed Dakota woman who was born in Vermilion, and she ends up working for the Equal Suffrage Society in the early 1890s and early 1900s. She lives on an allotment near Pierre and was very active with the newspaper press and even was a delegate to the National American Woman Suffrage Association in 1907 and 10. But we don't have as much evidence. But in that case, we see, you know, women thinking that there's a potential, indigenous women thinking there's a potential with the larger movement to push voting rights forward. Mm. And possibly women, you know, women could be allies. But it takes a long time, and there's a lot of beliefs that have to die before indigenous peoples are given the basic right to vote, not mentioning anything that might restrict it.
Right. Let's talk about the centennial celebration yesterday and the delegation and what happens next here in South Dakota.
Well, there is a group of about 50 or so women who've come together with the endorsement of Governor Noem, and we're an all-volunteer, nonpartisan group, hoping to spur activities and discussion about women's suffrage and voting rights, and to encourage voting in this upcoming election year. And we're hoping to have many activities and events, and soon, I don't think it's quite up yet, but soon we'll have a website that hopefully members of our state can go to see what might be going on women's suffrage. We're working under the phrase, her vote, her voice.
All right. Lots.
And so much is to be unfolded over the next few months, looking up to August 26th, of course, when the federal 19th Amendment is certified by the U.S. Congress, and then women vote for the first time in 1920. So the election will be very historic, too.
Yeah, and it's a book whose time definitely is, time has come, and the timing is really effective. It's called Equality at the Ballot Box, Votes for Women on the Northern Great Plains, and it's really digging into research from various scholars about what was happening in places like Wyoming and in the Dakotas and beyond. Molly, thank you so much for being here. We look forward to spending a lot of time with you next year.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Midwest singer-songwriter Chad Elliott blends folk roots, swampy blues, and soulful writing to deliver an original Americana sound. His live performances have been honed over a decade of being on the road, performing more than 200 shows each year. Chad Elliott has released his 22nd album, and he performs Friday night at the AME Allen Chapel in Yankton as part of their Little White Church Sessions. He joined Lori Walsh for this conversation.
Hey, Chad, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Great to be here. Thank you.
Have you played the Little White Church before? You've played a lot of venues.
Yeah, I have not played there, though. I've had friends, though, that tell me it's great, so I'm looking forward to it.
You shift between, you know, playing solo in an intimate setting like this and having, you know, really close connection with an audience to playing with the band. How does that sort of change the experience for you as an artist?
You know, I cut my teeth more of a solo artist, and so the band thing has been a learning curve, you know. I have a lot of fun with the band. I kind of throw them for a loop, and I had to find the right band members because I'm so used to performing solo that I might change the key of a song that night and never have played it in that key before. And so the band that are really complimentary to what I already did before for many years, but the intimate setting, I can tell a lot more intimate stories, and I feel like I'm completely exposed for between me and the audience. It's a really thin, you know, veil. So
right, which is something that you do on your podcast, and you know, as an artist and in your lyrics and as a visual artist, you put a lot of yourself out there. How do people respond to that? I know how I respond to it as a listener, but when you see people in the audience, how do they respond to that personally?
I feel like I'm making friends all over the country that way.
Yeah.
I feel like they come up, and I can tell when somebody's really been touched by a story or a song because they have a serious look on their face, like, "Hey, we're brothers," or we're family now. And I love that. That's been the most rewarding part about my music career. Is I might not have the most playlists or on Spotify or anything like that, you know, but I do have connections that I've made, and I think that's I couldn't ask for a better life.
At this point in your career, and you've done this is your 22nd album, for people who are just discovering you, What a rewarding experience, though, that there's so much there. I mean, like, you immediately you say, you know, you look around and like, why have I not known who Chad Elliott was until now? Mm-hmm. And then there's other people who've been following you for years and are rewarded for that long-term, you know, fan following. It's a relationship that you have with these people that's a little hard to define and get your arms around.
Yes. Yeah. I can only just be grateful for it. I feel like, you know, the stories keep coming. When I first started doing this, I had the same story for a year, and I was like, oh, I'm really leaning on the same stories at my shows. I wonder if I'm going to get more. I was kind of naive. And I just, you know, so along the way, I've kind of collected these stories that go along with the songs. And so tonight, you know, it's 20 years of just collecting these things, and I can kind of choose, and it's hard to choose sometimes within, you know, a 2-hour span to kind of right. go, oh, this is where I'm going with it. So yeah.
For a moment in sound today here, what will you play for us first?
This first one here is called Dirty River Catfish Blues.
Nice.
And it's my 6-year-old son's favorite song.
All right. Here we go.
Bottle of my poetry on that thing you gave me. Got too tired of the same old song. Oh, dirty river, come take me where we're going, I can't see. Once again, I'm falling to your fold. 'Cause a thirsty man will walk all the way to the sea. That cool, dirty river's holding water for me. I can't sink and I can't swim. Catfish feelings back again. Oh, dirty river, clean my soul. If you don't ask, I won't tell. I won't risk me catching it. Just see you can bend me to your will. I would like to remind you of a man you once loved, tried and true, and all the holes he left I can't fill. 'Cause a diamond in the rough I am not. I'm more like that big old bottom feeder that you caught. I can't sink and I can't swim. Catfish feelings back again. Oh, dirty river, clean my soul. Sink, but you can't make him take a drink if he don't want to help himself. It's kind of like that thirsty horse, you lead him straight to the source, but if he's stubborn as a mule, it don't help. Also, don't work too hard when it's hot outside. That cool, dirty river's all you got sometimes. I can't sink and I can't swim. Catfish feelings back again. Oh, dirty river, clean my soul. No, a diamond in the rough, I am not. I'm more like that big old bottom feeder that you caught. I can't sink and I can't swim. Catfish feelings back again. Oh, dirty river, clean my soul. Oh, dirty river, clean my soul.
If you're just tuning in, that's Chad Elliott for today's Moment in Sound. He is playing live in the SDPB Vermilion Studios right now. You can find him online at chadelliott.net, and you can see him tonight for the Little White Church sessions at the AME Allen Chapel in Yankton. Wow, that was a great song. I have to agree with your 6-year-old. That's pretty hard to beat, right?
Oh, thank you.
He probably hasn't had enough years to hear the whole catalog, though. So he'll,
that's right. Yeah. I'm going to have to sit him down.
Exactly. Okay, wait a minute. Tell me about, you know, being a dad, being an artist, being a visual artist, being a storyteller, all the different things that you do. You know, we say the word, you know, Renaissance man, and that's not a marketing tool for you. That's like the real, that's like the real definition here of how you live your life. Do those things all, are they different expressions of the same part of you? Or they all feed into each other? Like, how do you look at those combinations? Because you're a stunning visual artist as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I feel like it's all the same place that's coming from. But I feel like my job is, all this time I've figured out that I just need to stay inspired, you know, as often as I can, and to be creative. And that includes family, and that includes, you know, friendships and everything. But, you know, when it comes to the poetry and the writing and the painting and everything, I feel like I'm just kind of listening to whispers. If I feel like my songs are kind of sounding the same, I just kind of go, I think I need to get away from that. Maybe I'll pick up a pen or a painting and start working on that. And if I find that I've found little cycles throughout the year when I'm better at certain things, like in the summertime, I stay away from writing so much as I just perform all the time. But I do write poetry a lot in the summers, and fall and spring are great painting times. And so I just try and keep up with the cycles. And it took me years to find that, because I didn't want to just pick one of them. And I really held my ground right out of grad school. I said, I'm going to try and stay with all of it, because I really want to just do it all.
Right. And people will convince you that you can't, that you have to focus on one or the other.
Yeah.
But there's some, you know, when you, Woody Guthrie is referenced a lot in your work, and Shel Silverstein mm-hmm. is referenced in your work. And then you do these outdoor murals, which is really public art. And when I think of someone like Woody Guthrie, and I think of the concepts of public art and who is it accessible mm-hmm. and who is art really for, there seems like there's really one story in some ways that you're part of One River.
Oh, I love that. Yes. Yeah, I feel like that the connection, I was in grad school when I decided I have to just leave and do the songwriting thing, because I found that I was kind of targeting towards just gallery receptions and talking, you know, highfalutin art critic stuff. And I thought, I really want, I'm getting away from who I am as a person and in my roots. I wanted to write songs and make art for everybody. And the fun part is I'm delivering paintings on tours and meeting people along the way, and it's become interwoven together. And it's just, I feel pretty grateful for that too.
Right. And those choices affect how you live your life, and how you live your life affects those artistic choices. Tell me a little bit about just walking around, and you mentioned, you know, I wonder if I'm going to get more stories. And, you know, you're not afraid to have a real life experience, which I think, you know, some people still are a little bit. They're afraid to have anything bad happen to them.
Yes.
I don't want to say like bad things have happened to you and you've turned them into art. But hey, bad things have happened to you and you've turned them into art. Talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember I was always kind of on the edge there. As a kid, I used to run away a lot. My mom, you know, laughs at it now, because it was really not running away. It was about across town, or, you know,
right.
And then I'd turn around and get back home. But I used to always think, you know, what's out there? And I'd see, even in my youth, I would see homeless people. And I ended up, you know, being homeless for a short while. And I would really hit bottom, you know, and to hit bottom, and to know that you can still stay inspired, it's kind of like, well, the rest of the life seems pretty easy now.
Right.
You can kind of, as long as I have these gifts that I've been given and to be able to share those things, I'll be okay no matter what happens. And so it just seems like it's always going to be rich, you know, filled with stories and other people's stories.
Let me ask you about running away, because you tell that story on your podcast, and, you know, we make light of it now, but there is something really deep about your desire to run away that has to do with being mm-hmm. found as well. And I'm wondering if, even as a child, you were searching for that connection and that desire to be heard as an artist, and it was manifesting itself and showing up in this, here's my knapsack, and you know, I'm never coming back kind of story that you were living out.
I when I used to, you know, plan these getaways,
right.
I was thinking of this place in my mind, you know, this place alone. I loved solitude, and I could spend hours alone even as a kid. You know, I would had this place in my mind, this meadow underneath these stars, and it was just an imaginary place, but it was a place of solace. And even just going there still to this day, it's kind of a respite from all the craziness, even if it's online stuff, Facebook stuff, or it's just chaos, you know. And so I use that as my grounding almost when creatively, but also spiritually. And I used to also know what my bare essentials are, too. As a kid, I used to think, what do I actually need in this world? And I really was kind of always in tune with that.
Right. That's how artists think as little children sometimes. One of the ways, I think, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, what will you play for us next?
I'm going to do a new one here. This is not recorded yet.
Excellent.
But it's Salt River Psalm. Make sure I got it. Okay. I had one line that I was going off of when I wrote this. It was the line that said, she would cry and I would taste salt. And I thought that was enough to start a song off of. So.
Indeed.
When I think back on how it went, all the years that she and I spent, going around and around like in a boxing ring, neither one of us could have foreseen. Oh, she would cry and I'd taste salt, and I'd try to fly when she needed firm ground. Seemed the time wasn't on our side, sweet Adeline, sweet Adeline. Seemed the time wasn't on our side, sweet Adeline, sweet Adeline. When the sun falls down, it sinks below that ridge of trees, this valley glows. It's beautiful, half dark, half light, just like looking into her eyes. How we lost what we thought won, I'll never quite understand. A river of tears runs away from me, but what's one more pinch of salt to the sea? River of tears runs away from me, but what's one more pinch of salt to the sea? Stars look on as the cuckoo bird sings his song. It's better to have loved and lost down here, but didn't we burn bright for a moment, dear? Oh, you would cry and I'd taste salt, and I'd try to fly when you needed firm ground. Seeing the time wasn't on our side, sweet Adeline, sweet Adeline. Seeing the time wasn't on our side, sweet Adeline, sweet Adeline.
That is Chad Elliott playing for A Moment in Sound from the STPB Sioux Falls studios. Well, I really love that. Well, when are you going to record that one so I can hear?
In March, actually.
In March.
Yep. Heading down to Muscle Shoals, Alabama to record that one.
Right. So a lot going on there, but I want to talk lyrically. because so much of that is incredibly poetic. And when you write poetry, you write song lyrics. Some poetry is fit for a song, some is fit for the page. Where do you sort of make some of those distinctions when you get a line? Or it could be visual art. I mean, maybe I can't speak to that, but you could. When something arrives in your notebook, how do you sort of make some of those? What kind of conversation do you have to say, what is this going to be?
Sometimes it'll be, if it comes in a couplet, already rhymed, I usually think, okay, that's a song, and it's kind of categorized that in my mind. But I'll have just these little one-liners, and I hold on to them, and I don't know if it's going to be, for a poem or not, and it depends on that day, really. If I feel like breaking all the rules, I just go poetry. And I don't have to hold into any form other than I do a lot of free verse poems. But I feel like they definitely are right in line. I know a lot of my songwriter friends or poet friends say that you can't cross the two. And I'm like, well, don't tell me I can't, because I will.
Right. Do they ever become visual representation? I mean, does that ever cross into visual art?
Yes. Yeah. Often. I actually had an art gallery exhibit about 10 years ago that was called Art Song, and they were all lyrical paintings. And I even have all my children's books, obviously. They have their children's songs. And so I try and blend them. Sometimes it just seems to be like in that season, I'll be painting similarly to how I'm writing. And I love to not try and make it happen, but it just happens sometimes, and I love looking back and going, oh, look at that, I didn't even realize I was doing that. So
when you look at children's literature, so much of children's literature is like that, can be lyrical, can be visual, can be poetic. Where do you see that sort of fitting into, because it's not just as a parent that you're interested, I'm guessing that you're interested in those stories as well, because there's a whole different, We have a river metaphor going here today, but there's like a whole different stream that goes off on, but they all connect again.
They do, and the older I get, the longer I do this, it just feels like they more and more connect, and I'm starting to actually reap the benefits of that and understand it a little more. But even as a 5-year-old, I was really inspired by Shel Silverstein and Jim Henson. I was a huge fan of all of that, and I wanted to be a ventriloquist. That was my first occupation, and so the innocence of the stories and moral tales and things like that, I just love that. And also learning, my grandfather was a theologian and a history professor, so he would always tell me a little bit about the mythology behind it, all these little common stories that everyone knew, like Star Wars, and I was just like, oh, wow, okay, it's a bigger world out there.
How old were you when you find out that Shel Silverstein does, songwriting and, Dr. Hook and his own art that is definitely for adults? And like, when do you get the fuller picture of, because I'm like 17 in San Francisco when I come across a Shel Silverstein book, and I'm like, what? I had no idea that this was part of his catalog for you.
Yeah, I was about 15, and I remember being blown away, just because I was already kind of a little rebel by then, and I loved it, and I had already decided I'm going to be an artist, and I loved music. I didn't start writing until I was 19, as a songwriter, but I think that definitely had a play in it.
The subversion and the irreverence of his vocal performances. I mean, come on.
Oh, right.
Yeah. All right, one more song for us, please, on today's Moment in Sound. What will this one be, please?
You bet. I'll do it. This one here is... I'll do this, called Same Old Way. This one won the Woody Guthrie Song Contest. If I go walking past the town signs, further on down the highway, will there be something waiting for me, or am I fooling myself again? I left this all behind long before you came across my mind. Nothing kept me from leaving that day, but
That day was nothing like today. I fell on my knees and I prayed the change would spare me, that I could stay, oh, that I could stay the same old way. Times are flying right before me. It's not like before when I was blind. I remember seeing only the colors of the beautiful western skies. But now things are much deeper. That makes the darks much darker. But the light shine brighter on your beautiful face. I fell on my knees and I prayed the change would spare me, that I could stay, oh, that I could stay the same old way. The colors turn and turn back again. There's always something to believe in. That's not what you're searching for. No, it's something more hidden. You could spend your life waiting around. You could find me up and leave this town. That's something just follows you, no matter which road you go down. I fell on my knees and I prayed the change would spare me, that I could stay, oh, that I could stay the same old way. So if I go walking past the town signs, further on down the highway, will there be something waiting for me, or am I fooling myself again? You know I left this all behind, long before you came across my mind. Nothing kept me from leaving that day, but that day was nothing like today. I fell on my knees and I prayed the change would spare me, that I could stay, oh, that I could stay. I fell on my knees and I prayed the change would spare me, that I could stay.
3 years ago, a Christmas CD was recorded knowing full well that the proceeds would benefit the Bishop Dudley House in Sioux Falls. This organization was chosen for personal reasons due to a family connection. The family has recorded another Christmas CD, and proceeds are going to benefit the Children's Home Society. Tommy Nesbitt, Jeff and Seth Barnett, and Carol Nesbitt joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Holiday music forges connection and fosters tradition, but it can also transform a community. This weekend, the Barnett Family Singers perform at First Congregational Church in downtown Sioux Falls. Their new release is called Angels Among Us, Holiday Music to Fight Mental Illness. All proceeds from the concert and CD sales benefit Children's Home Society. 3 years ago, the Christmas CD Home for the Holidays raised money to support Bishop Dudley Hospitality House. And now joining us in the SDPB Sioux Falls studios to talk about the concert and the CDs, we welcome Jeff and Seth Barnett along with Carol Nesbitt. Jeff, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Hey, I'm delighted.
Hey, Seth. Welcome.
Thank you.
Carol, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks so much, Lori, for having us.
Joining us on the phone, Tom Barnett. Tom, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
All right, let's start with this current CD and the Barnett Family Singers. There's some addition to who's singing now. Carol, tell us a little bit about this CD, please.
So about 7 or so years ago, Jeff and I did a CD for a children's charity, and 3 years ago we decided to do another one. We brought Seth in on that and had a Christmas CD, which, as you said, raised money for Bishop Dudley House because we had a brother who was homeless a lot due to some addictions. And so anyway, so we raised, we think, about $20,000 for Bishop Dudley House. And so we decided to do it again this year. And Jeff decided to bring in another nephew, Seth's brother, Zach. And so then we decided to bring in two more nieces. So now there are 6 family members who are singing on the CD and 6 family members who will be singing this Sunday. And so,
whose voice did we just hear there?
That was beautiful. Yeah. Oh, I know. That was my daughter, Claire, right. Who's 11 years old, or actually just had her 12th birthday. And so it was really fun to bring her in and kind of part of the next generation.
Right. So tell me a little bit about growing up, because your dad died fairly young and music is a huge part of who you are as a family.
Sure. Well, my mom, we had kind of a crazy good luck that there was just naturally in the family a soprano, alto, and a tenor, and a bass. So we had a natural quartet. And we all sang for the legendary Sioux Falls director, conductor, Ron Schoenkamp, who recently passed, and very close to our whole family. And so we, all of us, had learned under his tutelage. And my mom really believed that we should give back to the community through our music. And because we had a father who had been an invalid for a long time before he died, my mom really encouraged us to go out into the community and perform for other people who, the infirm, the elderly, went to nursing homes, and people who were shut into their homes during the winter months. And so it became kind of a Christian service on our part. And that really inspires this project today, because even though all of us sing professionally and have lots of gigs where we're making money and going out and doing those activities, we all felt very strongly that we want music to also be an opportunity to give back, and that's what really brought this project to fruition.
So then what is it like to be, to have a CD in your hand, for example, that all this creative work has gone into and this technical work, because, it needs to be a really high standard. And then you hand it to somebody and they say, how much? And you say, make a donation. And then they write a check for $500, or they write a check for $10
exactly.
Because that's what they have. Or they
exactly.
Write, yeah. Tell me a little bit about that moment, which is...
Well, the neat thing is that Jeff and his wife have been blessed, and so they have underwritten the entire cost, so that when people come to our concert, there's no ticket price. It's whatever you feel compelled to give to Children's Home Society. It goes directly to them. If you wrote a check, it would be to Children's Home Society. And additionally, with the CD, you can take one. If you'd like to give a donation to Children's Home Society, we would love that. And we've gotten everywhere from $5 to $1,000 for a CD. And it just varies depending on people's ability to give. And so we hope by doing the concert on Sunday, we're going to share kind of our story and why we chose Children's Home Society, have someone, a family member, speak to that, and then, who was helped by Children's Home Society, Tom, who's on the phone, and also someone from Children's Home Society, so that people understand the great need that there is to help young people who are struggling with all kinds of emotional or mental health issues.
Right. Michelle LaValle is leading Children's Home Society now. She was recently on this program, and you can hear that conversation online at listen.stpb.org. But Tom Barnett, I want to bring you into the conversation here on the phone, because Children's Home Society means a lot to you personally. Tell people a little bit about some of the services that they provide and what you know about them.
So one of the main services that they provide is, well, of course, a place to live, and that's very important. And another thing that they provide that a lot of kids that go there don't have is optimism, because, they give hope to kids that in almost any other situation would not have it, because there's a lot of things going wrong in their life at that time. And I think that's one of the best things you can give to a kid.
Yeah. What have they meant to your life? When you think back now and you think back to your connection with Children's Home Society, what are some of the things that you remember?
Well, one of the things that I remember is that when I first got into Children's Home, I wasn't a very positive person, because I didn't have a lot to look up to. And if you talk to me now, you'll know I'm one of the most positive people there are. And I really appreciate that about Children's Home.
We're going to play a little more music from this latest CD, and you have to help me tell me which CD this is on, but this is a little bit of Seth singing. We're going to bring Seth into the conversation next, but first let's hear a little bit from Bring Him Home. Interrupt that, Seth. Thank you for that. You know, I have headphones on right now, and that sounds really great in headphones. If you're in your car, I'm sure it sounds pretty good too. But go home and put your headphones on as soon as you get the chance. A recognizable song for many people from Les Mis. Tell us a little bit about your connection with the sort of family music tradition and how it expresses in your life.
Sure. So, you know, as mentioned, it's really cool to be a part of. Such a musical family, you know, going back multiple generations. So really cool to be involved on this project, you know, with my mother singing as a child, and then now bringing in, you know, us younger, you know, the next generation to then, you know, kind of join the project with them.
Yeah, that's not an easy piece to sing.
No, it's really cool. With our CD, you know, we did some popular, you know, some popular hymns or different songs that people would recognize, but then so also a couple different chants, you know, medieval chants, and then that song as well from a popular musical that a lot of people wouldn't recognize. So it's really cool to incorporate those different aspects and different, you know, different pieces and different styles so that people can connect with ones that they, you know, are already familiar with, but also learn and love new music as well.
Jeff, do you have creative differences as a family? Go ahead, dish something. No.
Well, I would say, you know, Carol and Seth both have tremendous skills across multiple genres of singing. I mean, Carol sings big band and jazz music. In fact, she has another gig in Sioux Falls this very week at the Pavilion, which I think next Tuesday, which will be amazing. I'm so sorry I can't be there for it. I, unfortunately, am pretty much terrible at popular music, and my children and my wife remind me of that daily. So I really have specialized in early music and oratorio and art song. And so for me to hear Seth sing a song like that so beautifully is really, really special. And I do have an appreciation for different styles of music, in part because I'm not very good at them. So I know what to do and how I can do it well.
There's a really neat thing that I wanted to share, that this music was written. Jeff had a very good friend from back in his college days who is an arranger who has done a lot of arranging for Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion show. His name is Paul Garricky, and he's extremely talented. He wrote all these arrangements for us. Mm-hmm. We told him what songs he wanted to do. We told him what our ranges were, and he did the song. So these arrangements have never been heard ever before. They've never been performed publicly. So that's pretty exciting to be part of that. And he's done the last couple of CDs for us.
We have an excerpt of the song, Mary, Did You Know? Tell me a little bit about this song, Carol. This is you, right?
It is me. I have just always loved this song. It's always touched my heart when you talk about, did you realize that when you kissed your little baby, you kissed the face of God? There's just such a, it's almost like a lullaby, and I absolutely just love it. And so when Jeff and I were talking about songs, I just said, you know, could I sing this one? You know, it's very different from some of the, as he said, some of the chants and some of the early American music and things. So.
that your baby boy would one day walk on water. Mary, did you know that your baby boy would save our sons and daughters? Did you know that your baby boy has come to make you new? And this child that you deliver, soon deliver you. Mary, did you know your baby boy will give sight to?
This is Poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Adrian C. Lewis. He was born on April 24, 1946, in northern Nevada as a member of the Lovelock Paiute tribe. At a young age, his family moved to the Pine Ridge Reservation, where he grew up. After finishing high school, Lewis was accepted into Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, where he graduated with a BA. Soon after, he received an MA in creative writing, also from Brown. He wrote over 20 books, including Muted War Drums, Skull Dance, Random Exorcisms, Electric Snakes, and also Skins, which was made into a popular film. Lewis won Writer of the Year by WordCraft Circle of Native Writers, a Pushcart Prize, and also fellowships from the Bush Foundation, as well as the South Dakota Arts Council. He taught at Oglala Lakota College for many years before taking up a position at Southwest Minnesota State University. He passed away on September 9th, 2018. Today's poem is Rhetoric Leads to Cliché. It takes place sometime in winter in Pine Ridge, and it involves the narrator, probably Lewis himself, who is passed on an icy road by white ranchers. To spite them, he roars past their pickup and races across the border onto Pine Ridge. Back home, he looks out the window and sees a frozen jacket in the snow. It reminds him of a famous black and white photo, the one taken of Bigfoot, that chief who was murdered, along with so many others, at Wounded Knee on December 29, 1890. This is a poem about loss, anger, melancholy, and repetition. This is Rhetoric Leads to Cliché by Adrian C. Lewis. The young white ranchers, with chew drippings down the door panel of their pickup, have never heard of communitas, because it is foreign to their 20-watt concept of America, where all men are equally constituted upon a quaint document which they praise with conceit and deceit in their hearts. That is the nature of the beast and breast be damned. Violence condoned in the name of goodness decries innocence, a word soon discarded when discovered the savages already possessed it. I am an Indian born upon Indian land, and I've been battered by myself and others for 9 rounds, but I am raging and ready for the 10th and final spurt of manhood. When the rednecks passed me in their white pickup and dropped a beer can in their wake, I tromped the gas pedal and passed them back stupidly, since the roads were sheet ice. I hovered in front of them for a minute, then fishtailed towards the horizon feeling good. I hit the reservation line and then slowed down. I remembered what my bumper sticker read, "Life is a bitch and then you die." Life is a bitch and then you die? Hours later at home, waiting for the old lady to get home and cook my beans, I stared at the icebox landscape of Pine Ridge and threw the faint, mirrored ghost of my own reflection upon the winterpane, some wino's coat frozen in the yard, half under snow, a rigid arm extended, reaching for air in this ghost scene, the dogs dragged home, this replication of what we have seen in that famous picture of 1890 by the hysterical Nebraska Historical Society, the Minneconjou chief Bigfoot frozen solid, one gnarled and bony arm extended into the chilled air of his cousin's land, a simple why in his death grimace. Tunkasilla, these white men hate all that is good, and we don't know why.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. All poems used with permission, recorded at Augustana University, and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org and on our daily podcast, In the Moment Segments. The In the Moment podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow Lori on Twitter, at @MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh, I'm Chris Lawfrey. Thanks for listening.